Some years ago, there lived in the suburbs of a large seaport town on the west coast of England, a man in humble circumstances by name Isaac Scatchard. His means of subsistence were derived from any employment that he could get as an ostler. Though a faithful, steady, and honest man, he got on badly in his calling. His ill luck was proverbial among his neighbours. With far more than one man's adversity to endure, Isaac had but one consolation to support him, and that was of the dreariest and most negative kind. He had no wife and children to increase his anxieties and add to the bitterness of his various failures in life. When he was out of service, he lived alone with his widowed mother. Mrs. Scatchard was a woman above the average in her lowly station as to capacity and manners, and she always managed to keep a decent home for her son to return to whenever his ill luck drove him out helpless into the world. One bleak autumn, when Isaac was getting on fast towards 40, and when he was, as usual, out of place through no fault of his own, he set forth from his mother's cottage on a long walk inland to a gentleman's seat where he had heard that a stable helper was required. It wanted then but 2 days of his birthday, and Mrs. Scatchard, with her usual fondness, made him promise before he started that he would be back in time to keep that anniversary with her in as festive a way as their poor means would allow. Arriving at his destination too late on the Monday night to make application for the stable helper's place, he slept at the village inn, and in good time on the Tuesday morning presented himself at the gentleman's house to fill the vacant situation. Here again, his ill luck pursued him as inexorably as ever. Only the day before, the stable helper's place had been given to another man. So, before starting on his homeward walk, he made some inquiries at the inn and ascertained that he might save a few miles on his return by following a new road. Just as it was getting towards dark, the rain came on and the wind began to rise, and he found himself, to make matters worse, in a part of the country with which he was entirely unacquainted. The first house he found to inquire at was a lonely roadside inn standing on the outskirts of a thick wood. The landlord was civil and respectable-looking, and the price he asked for a bed was reasonable enough. Isaac therefore decided on stopping comfortably at the inn for that night. At a little after 11, the house was closed. Isaac went round with the landlord and held the candle while the doors and lower windows were being secured. He noticed with surprise the strength of the bolts and bars and iron-sheathed shutters.
"You see, well, we're rather lonely here," said the landlord. "Now, here's where you're to sleep. You're our only lodger tonight, and I think you'll say my missus has done her best to make you comfortable."
Isaac locked the door, set his candle on the chest of drawers, and wearily got ready for bed. Sleep stole on him before he was aware of it. His eyes closed, and he fell off insensibly to rest without having so much as thought of extinguishing the candle. The first sensation of which he was conscious after sinking into slumber was a strange shivering that ran through him suddenly from head to foot, and a dreadful sinking pain at the heart such as he had never felt before. The shivering only disturbed his slumbers. The pain woke him instantly. In one moment, he passed from a state of sleep to a state of wakefulness, his eyes wide open, his mental perceptions cleared on a sudden as if by a miracle. Between the foot of his bed and the closed door, there stood a woman with a knife in her hand, looking at him. She said not a word as they stared each other in the face, but she began to move slowly towards the left-hand side of the bed. His eyes followed her. She was a fair, fine woman, with yellowish flaxen hair and light grey eyes, with a droop in the left eyelid. Speechless, with no expression in her face, with no noise following her footfall, she came closer and closer, stopped, and slowly raised the knife. He laid his right arm over his throat to save it, but as he saw the knife coming down, threw his hand across the bed to the right side and jerked his body over that way just as the knife descended on the mattress within an inch of his shoulder. His eyes fixed on her arm and hand as she slowly drew her knife out of the bed. A white, well-shaped arm with a pretty down lying lightly over the fair skin. A delicate lady's hand, with the crowning beauty of a pink flush under and round the fingernails. She drew the knife out and passed back again slowly to the foot of the bed. Stopped there for a moment looking at him, then came on to the right side of the bed where he now lay. As she approached, she raised the knife again, and he drew himself away to the left side. She struck, as before, right into the mattress with a deliberate downward action of the arm. This time, his eyes wandered from her to the knife. It was like the large clasp knives which he had often seen laboring men use to cut their bread and bacon with. For the second time, she drew the knife out, concealed it in the wide sleeve of her gown, and stopped by the bedside, watching him. For an instant, he saw her standing in that position. Then the wick of the spent candle fell over into the socket. The flame diminished to a little blue point, and the room grew dark. Then the wick flamed up, smoking for the last time. The fair woman with the knife was gone. With the dreadful conviction of the reality of what he had seen still strong within him, he leapt out of the bed screaming, "Murder! Wake up there! Wake up!" and dashed headlong through the darkness to the door. It was fast locked, exactly as he had left it on going to bed. His cries on starting up had alarmed the house. He heard the terrified, confused exclamations of women. He saw the master of the house approaching along the passage with his burning rush candle in one hand and his gun in the other. "What is it?" Isaac could only answer in a whisper.
"A woman with a knife in her hand, in my room, a fair, yellow-haired woman. She jabbed at me with a knife twice over."
Well, she seems to have missed you twice."
"Well, I dodged the knife as it came down. It struck the bed each time."
The landlord took his candle into the bedroom immediately. In less than a minute, he came out again into the passage in a violent passion.
"The devil fly away with you and your woman with a knife. There isn't a mark in the bedclothes anywhere. What do you mean by coming into a man's place and frightening his family out of their wits about a dream?"
"Well, I'll leave your house better out on the road in rain and dark on my road home than back again in that room after what I've seen in it."
They parted without a word on either side. Little did the darkness or the cold or the uncertainty about the way home matter to Isaac. He could make nothing of the mystery, had made nothing of it, even when it was midday on Wednesday, and when he stood at last, after many times missing his road, once more on the doorstep of home. His mother came out eagerly to receive him. His face told her in a moment that something was wrong.
"I've lost the place, but that's my luck. I dreamed an ill dream last night, Mother. Or maybe I saw a ghost."
And he told her what had passed at the inn. His mother's face grew paler and paler as he went on. She never interrupted him by so much as a single word. But when he had done, she moved her chair close to his, put her arm round his neck, and said to him,
"Isaac, you dreamed your ill dream on Wednesday morning. What time was it when you saw the fair woman with the knife in her hand?"
Somewhere about 2 in the morning.
His mother suddenly quitted her hold of his neck and struck her hands together with a gesture of despair.
"This Wednesday is your birthday, Isaac, and 2 o'clock in the morning was the time when you were born."
Isaac's capacities were not quick enough to catch the infection of his mother's superstitious dread. He was amazed and a little startled also when she suddenly rose from the chair, opened her old writing desk, took pen, ink, and paper, and then said to him,
"Your memory is but a poor one, Isaac, and now I'm an old woman, mine's not much better. I want all about this dream of yours to be as well known to both of us years hence as it is now.
Tell me over again all you told me a minute ago when you spoke of what the woman with the knife looked like."
Isaac obeyed, and marveled much as his mother set down on paper every detail. She then locked up the paper carefully in her writing desk. Neither on that day, nor on any day after,
could her son induce her to return to the matter of the dream. Ere long, Isaac grew weary of attempting to make her break her resolute silence, and time, which sooner or later wears out all things, gradually wore out the impression produced on him by the dream. He began by thinking of it carelessly, and he ended by not thinking of it at all. The result was the more easily brought about by the advent of some important changes for the better in his prospects, which commenced not long after his terrible night's experience at the inn. He got an excellent place and left it only on the death of his master. Thus it happened that Isaac Scatchard returned to his old mother 7 years after the time of the dream at the inn with an annual sum of money at his disposal sufficient to keep them both in ease and independence for the rest of their lives. On that day, as the evening drew on, Mrs. Scatchard discovered that a bottle of tonic medicine which she was accustomed to take happened to be empty. Isaac immediately volunteered to go to the chemist's and get it filled again. It was as rainy and bleak an autumn night as on the memorable past occasion when he lost his way and slept at the roadside inn. On going into the chemist's shop, he was passed hurriedly by a poorly dressed woman coming out of it. The glimpse he had of her face struck him, and he looked back after her as she descended the doorsteps.
"You're noticing that woman?" said the chemist's apprentice behind the counter. "It's my opinion there's something wrong with her. She's been asking for laudanum to put on a bad tooth. Well, the master's out for half an hour, and I told her I wasn't allowed to sell poison to strangers in his absence. She laughed in a queer way and said she'd come back in half an hour. It's a case of suicide, sir, if ever there was one yet."
These words added immeasurably to the sudden interest in the woman Isaac had felt at the first sight of her face. After he had got the medicine bottle filled, he looked about anxiously for her as soon as he was out in the street. She was walking slowly up and down on the opposite side of the road. Isaac crossed over and spoke to her. He asked if she was in any distress. She pointed to her torn shawl, her scanty dress, her crushed, dirty bonnet, then moved under a lamp so as to let the light fall on her stern, pale, but still most beautiful face. Little by little, in answer to his questions, the sad story of the woman came out. There is no need to relate it here. It's told over and over again in police reports and paragraphs about attempted suicides.
"My name is Rebecca Murdoch. I have 9 pence left, and I thought of spending it at the chemist's over the way in securing a passage to the other world."
All that Isaac could say in answer to her last reckless words was that he would prevent her from attempting her own life if he followed her about all night to do it. His rough, trembling earnestness seemed to impress her.
"Now, I won't occasion you that trouble. You have given me a fancy for living by speaking kindly to me. Come to Fuller's Meadow tomorrow at 12, and you will find me alive to answer for myself."
The next day, Isaac went to Fuller's Meadow. He had done only right in believing her so implicitly. She was there, punctual to a minute, to answer for herself. The last left faint defences in Isaac's heart against the fascination which a word or look from her began inscrutably to exercise over him sank down and vanished before her for ever on that memorable morning. In less than a month from the time when he first met her, Isaac Scatchard had consented to give Rebecca Murdoch a new interest in existence and a chance of recovering the character she had lost by promising to make her his wife. He announced his marriage engagement precipitately and confusedly to his mother on the day when he contracted it. Poor Mrs. Scatchard showed her perfect confidence in her son by flinging her arms round his neck and giving him joy of having found, at last, a woman to comfort and care for him after his mother was gone. She was all eagerness to see the woman of her son's choice, and the next day was fixed for the introduction. Punctual to the appointed time, Isaac hurriedly and nervously led his promised wife into the room. His mother rose to receive her, advanced a few steps, smiling, looked Rebecca full in the eyes, and suddenly stopped.
"Isaac,"
she whispered, clutching him fast by the arm when he asked alarmedly if she was taken ill.
Isaac, does that woman's face remind you of nothing?
Well, before he could answer, his mother pointed impatiently to her writing desk and gave him the key.
Open it and give me the paper in the left-hand drawer. Quick, quick, for heaven's sake.
Isaac gave her the paper. Something like fear began to steal over Rebecca's face.
Mad. And Isaac never told me.
With these few words, she left the room. Isaac was hastening after her when his mother turned and stopped his farther progress.
Light grey eyes, she said, pointing towards the open door. A droop in the left eyelid, flaxen hair with a gold-yellow streak in it, white arms with a down upon them, little lady's hand with a reddish look under the fingernails. The dream woman, Isaac, the dream woman. Oh, be warned, oh, my son, be warned. Isaac, Isaac, let her go. And do you stop with me?
Something darkened the parlor window as those words were said. A sudden chill ran through him, and he glanced sidelong at the shadow. Rebecca Murdoch had come back. She was peering in curiously at them over the low window blind.
No, I've promised to marry, Mother.
And marry I must. 3 weeks after that day, Isaac and Rebecca were man and wife. All that was hopelessly dogged and stubborn in the man's moral nature seemed to have closed round his fatal passion and to have fixed it unassailably in his heart. After some quiet months of married life, as the summer was ending and the year was getting on towards the month of his birthday, Isaac found his wife altering towards him. She grew sullen and contemptuous. She formed acquaintances of the most dangerous kind in defiance of his objections, his entreaties, and his commands. And, worst of all, she learned ere long, after every fresh difference with her husband, to seek the deadly self-oblivion of drink. His mother was the first to notice the sad alteration in him, and the first to hear of his last worst trouble with his wife. Her health was failing fast, and greatly deteriorated after seeing that the knife which her son's wife used to cut the bread exactly corresponded to the knife in the dream. Within a few weeks, she had breathed her last. Isaac was present at her death, and her last words in this world were addressed to him.
Don't go back, my son. Don't go back.
Well, he was obliged to go back, if it were only to watch his wife. Exasperated to the last degree by his distrust of her, she had revengefully sought to add a sting to his grief during the last days of his mother's illness by declaring that she would assert her right to attend the funeral. In spite of all that he could do or say, she held with wicked pertinacity to her word, and on the day appointed for the burial, forced herself, inflamed and shameless with drink, into her husband's presence and declared that she would walk in the funeral procession to his mother's grave. Now, this last worst outrage, accompanied by all that was most insulting in word and look, maddened him for the moment. He struck her. The instant the blow was dealt, he repented it.
No man has ever struck me twice, and my husband shall have no second opportunity. Set the door open and let me go. From this day forth, we see each other no more.
Before he could answer, she passed him and left the house. He saw her walk up the street. Would she return? All that night he watched and waited, but no footstep came near the house. The next night, overpowered by fatigue, he lay down in bed in his clothes, with the door locked, the key on the table, and the candle burning. His slumber was not disturbed. The third night, the fourth, the sixth passed, and nothing happened. He lay down on the seventh, still in his clothes, still with the door locked, the key on the table and the candle burning, but easier in his mind. Easier in his mind and in perfect health of body when he fell off to sleep. But his rest was disturbed. He woke twice
without any sensation of uneasiness. But the third time, it was that never-to-be-forgotten shivering of the night at the lonely inn, that dreadful sinking pain at the heart, which once more aroused him in an instant. His eyes opened towards the left-hand side of the bed, and there stood the dream woman again? No. His wife. The living reality. With the dream spectre's face in the dream spectre's attitude, the fair arm up, the knife clasped in the delicate white hand. He sprang upon her almost at the instant of seeing her, and yet not quickly enough to prevent her from hiding the knife. Without a word from him, without a cry from her, he pinioned her in a chair. With one hand he felt up her sleeve, and there, where the dream woman had hidden the knife, his wife had hidden it, the knife with the buckhorn handle that looked like new. In the despair of that fearful moment, his brain was steady, his heart was calm. He looked at her fixedly with a knife in his hand and said these last words. You told me we should see each other no more, and you have come back. It is my turn now to go, and to go forever. I say that we shall see each other no more, and my word shall not be broken. He left her and set forth into the night. The distant church clocks chimed the quarter as he walked rapidly beyond the last houses in the suburb. He asked the first policeman he met what hour that was of which the quarter had just struck. The man referred sleepily to his watch and answered, 2 o'clock. 2 in the morning. Well, what day of the month was this day that had just begun? He reckoned it up from the date of his mother's funeral. The fatal parallel was complete. It was his birthday. Had he escaped the mortal peril which his dream foretold, or had he only received a second warning? When he ventured back to the house, a picklock lay on the floor, betraying how she had gained entrance in the night, and that was the only trace of her, the one last useless trace of the dream woman. Since that time, Isaac himself has the one perpetual thought about her, that she is alive and looking for him. He wouldn't let himself drop off to sleep towards 2 in the morning for a king's ransom. 2 in the morning, he says, is the time she will find him, one of these days. 2 in the morning is the time, all the year round, when he likes to be certain he has got that knife safe about him. She's looking for me, is all he says when anybody speaks to him about the one anxiety of his life. She's looking for me. Well, he may be right. She may be looking for him. Who can tell? Who can tell?
The Dream Woman by Wilkie Collins was adapted by Michael Bakewell. It was read by David Suchet and produced by Rosemary Hart.